Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you again. We did some teaching on Thursday night. Hope you were able to listen in. But this morning is Sunday, and we're going to do something a little different today. During the evenings, when I'm still here for Pastor Robbie, I will continue some study on archaeology. Today we'll be working on a book sermon. We'll look at the whole book. You'll be experts in the book of Ruth when this is over. I was telling a couple of people before I got up here that this was in seminary years and years ago when barely they had computers. I read the book of Ruth all the way through in Hebrew. That was an assignment for the course. So what I want to do is give you the first Bethlehem story. We always think about the birth of Christ. Of course, that's appropriate. In December, we consider the fact that you have a man who was merely a construction worker and a woman who was a young woman. In those days, the age differentiation was quite different. But a very young woman and this older man who get married. But their plans did not turn out exactly as they anticipated. And so we know we have angelic visits that make sure everything's straight and all of that. And that's the second Bethlehem story, though. We're going to talk about another one. It is not really quite as dramatic, it appears, on the surface, but it changes. And when you look at this book in the Old Testament, there are a lot of exciting books with all sorts of adventures, and of course the book of Judges, which this particular book starts with. He says, in the days that the judges were judging, and something special happens that was never anticipated either. God is always a God of surprises. A lot of things that no one ever thought about. I'm sure the people of Israel, as they stood there at the sea thinking, we've got a problem, God had a solution, and they had not investigated. They had never thought about that the water was going to open up and they could get across. God is that kind of God. And the way I've dealt with this today, if you'll notice, it's the fact that the hidden God is in control. This book is about God, but it doesn't appear that way on the surface. This second Bethlehem story is a story of God's eternal Son entering into humanity, which is talked about in the second Bethlehem story in the book of Matthew and the book of Luke in the New Testament. This one has to happen before the second one can happen. And that's based on something that God initiated in eternity and worked out in time. Abraham, when he was but Abram, in a little place in Ur of the Chaldees, was not a massive place, sort of isolated. God came to him out of nowhere and said, hey, I'm here. And who are you? he was not one of the gods of the nations. They had a lot of gods in those days. And up comes one who says to him, listen, I've got something I want you to do. And I want you to go to a land that you have no clue where it is and you've never been there. And I'm going to give it to you. I'm sure Abraham at that point was really figuring out what is going on. I'm supposed to go there because I have this visitation. And of course he does. And some interesting things happen that also relate to the second Bethlehem story, the birth of Christ. God works out plans differently than we do. He not only knows the beginning, but the ending and everything in between. Nothing takes him by surprise because not only does he know, but he is in charge. He is in charge of every molecule, every event. There's nothing that happens that he's not in charge of. Now, he operates two ways. Either he causes things to happen, or he allows things to happen that happen through other means. But he's always in charge. That's why we have that very famous statement of Paul in Romans chapter 11, when he ends up his whole discussion of God's work in all these different facets and with Israel and so forth, and he ends up and he says, "For from him and through him and to him are all things." That covers it. From the origin, the end, and the middle. Everything is of God. And so that's important for us to understand. This is a story, then, of how God begins to put together a plan. And this plan he initiated in this Abrahamic covenant. I don't know if you've seen this slide before, because a lot of us behind the scenes borrow each other's stuff. But I actually developed this a little differently, and I'll probably see it somewhere else sometime. There's a group of us, Tommy Ives, Robbie Dean, Randall Price, a few of us who share things back and forth. But if you look at this, you have the Abrahamic covenant has three components. One is land, one is seed, and one is blessing. And all through history, we see these things working out. Land relates to the land covenant that God made with Abraham. So when we say that God gave a covenant with Abraham, it is not merely one component, it is all three. And they work out in different ways. He tells Abram at that point, he says, "Listen, you're going to take a nap for a little while, and I'm going to make a unilateral, unconditional covenant that will be fulfilled without any possibility that it won't." It's very important, because a lot of people believe that the covenant that God made with Abraham in this and these components were actually set aside because the people were disobedient. That's not true, because even in Deuteronomy, God says, "Listen, this is what the covenant is. Now, this is what I'm going to do. This is what you're going to do. You're going to blow it. You're going to goof up all these things. I'm going to come back. I'm going to restore it." He sort of lets them know the whole history before they even get into the land, how they're going to goof everything up, but he's going to bring them back. Why? Because God is a God of the end and the beginning and the middle. That's what we have to keep in mind. And this covenant of the land covenant is the covenant of Israel itself. Not Israel that we see today, but Israel as it will be finally. We know the actual dimensions of the land. It will cover, I'm sorry, the Jordanians will not be happy about this, but eventually they won't have that. It will be Israel's. And everything up to the Euphrates and so forth. It's all been laid out, and God says, "My covenant with Israel in this regard does not depend upon their obedience. It depends upon my faithfulness." That's why it's a unilateral covenant. You know what a unilateral is, right? They didn't sort of make a deal. "I'll do this, you do this. What's a consideration, you know, to make it all happen?" God put Abraham to sleep. Second time, Adam got to sleep. Now Abraham gets to sleep. He puts him to sleep, and he walks between the parcels that have been cut. And the word covenant means to cut in Hebrew, berit, to cut. And they would cut the animals in half, and they would walk through them, and they say the covenant is secured, because if either of the parties in a bilateral covenant, if either of the parties back out, look at the animals, that's going to be you. They didn't need lawyers. They solved it other ways. And so what happens is that God, he puts Abram to sleep, and he walks through by himself, alone. How is the covenant going to be secured? It's secured because God is a God of all things, and he's in control. And so there's land. And second, there is covenant reference to seed. That is, it's not going to be just anybody who occupies this, but it's going to go through a particular people. And the people is designated from Abram, who was not, by the way, a Jew. There were no Jews at that point. He was not an Israelite. He was actually right now trying to figure out where Israel was. And God, however, works through him, through Abraham, Isaac, and finally Jacob, who becomes Israel. And now we have the Israelites. God has worked all this out. Human beings were not in charge of it, actually. And so it's going to come what we call the Davidic covenant. And you can read on that in 2 Samuel. We don't have the time today. Then there's a third part of the covenant that also is fulfilled. And it's a covenant of blessing. And this covenant includes Gentiles. So when you read Galatians 3 sometimes, and it talks about that the church actually is benefited by the one who is, in fact, the securer of the promise, that is Jesus, it's referring to this part of the covenant, not the totality, but this part of the covenant. That is a covenant of blessing to the Gentiles, of which I am one. Some of you may have some others blood with you, but I just have that. And so a covenant of blessing that we see here, we end up calling the new covenant. But it's not separate from the Abrahamic covenant. It's a part of it. It's just that I don't get any land and I don't get a kingdom. In fact, I get the blessing. Now, if you look at the bottom, it says Gentiles and the blessing through Christ the seed, and you can read those passages on that. I just want to give you some background. You probably know it, but that is why ultimately what we see that happens in Ruth and what happens in Matthew and Luke, what we see there is because of this. Ultimately, though, because of God's intentions in eternity, who is from and through and to. So when we look at this, we see the background to the story. Now, the book of Ruth is written, again, not in a very good time. I know many of us feel a lot of pressures today because of things going on. But I want you to know the time of the judges was not a very good time. Even the best judges didn't qualify for church membership if they had an opportunity. You look at these guys and you think, wow, go to Hebrews 11 and read about all these people of marvelous deeds. I mean, who isn't interested in Samson? What a colorful person and what a sinful one. I mean, he has some pros and some cons, and unfortunately, most of them are cons. And yet God worked through him to fulfill his purposes. See, Samson hadn't planned those things to happen the way they did. God was in charge. And so we have people like Samson. Then you have a guy like Gideon. And Gideon was a man who constantly had doubts and trying to figure out what to do. He had struggles in life. He really did. And he was successful not because of Gideon. He was successful because God's in charge. God put it together eventually that even though Gideon had 30,000 soldiers, before he knew it, he had 300. Well, we got enough soldiers now. Let's go into battle. Anybody in our way of thinking with common sense who's leading an army would prefer 30,000 to 300 going against a group of people that were more than that. Well, but God had plans. And so God takes Gideon and he does wonderful things through him, even though he was not a man of a lot of conviction. He had a lot of difficulties in life. Then you can turn to Jephthah. My goodness, Jephthah has all sorts of problems, and he comes from that same line from Gideon. And we could go through the various individuals in the book of Judges, but the reason why I mention it is because, look, it says, in the days that the judges were judging, that's our time period. Can anything good come out of all this mediocrity and difficulty? Yes, the first Bethlehem story. Because it's here that God begins to move toward the second. And so a lot of wonderful things happened in the book. And you sort of have to get the flavor of what's going on. Because it's not a time of high spirituality. It's not. I mean, there's a lot of people with problems. Even your best weren't very good. And in the midst of all that, you have the first words of this book. Ruth is a theological story and not just a nice story. It's a book about God's faithfulness to his covenant. Again, it's going to happen. Everything he says is going to happen. I have a lot of my friends who have sort of taken over the fact that the church has become Israel and all this stuff. The fact it never happened that way. And what they've somehow thought, well, people when they're unfaithful must somehow invalidate God's plans, invalidate God's purposes. No. Abram says, or God says to Abram, you know, I'm going to be in charge of this covenant, not you. So, it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled. Now, you like books to read like, anybody read The Tale of Two Kingdoms? I liked that, but I saw the movie and read the book. wonderful book about a terrible time, the time of the French Revolution. Very fascinating. And it says, in the very first statement of the book, when he starts it out very famously, when he talks about it was the worst of times, it was the best of times. It's a time of plenty, it's a time of disaster. It's this and that. It looked good and bad simultaneously. Or you have other books that begin in different ways. You ever read our even passage? You ever read Isaiah chapter 6? It says, it starts off, in the year that King Uzziah died. Maybe I'll preach an Isaiah sermon sometime to you. In the year that King Uzziah died, what's so important? You started off with this statement of death. But if you don't understand that statement, you miss the whole passage. The statement lends the understanding of the passage because of the contrast. And the same thing is true here. In the days that when the judges ruled, when everything seemed to be debauchery and lack of faithfulness, idolatry, even people who were Israelites were being, they were worshiping other gods. All these things were going on. In the days that the judges were judging, God was involved in putting something together that nobody anticipated. May I suggest that may be the case even today? When it looks like everything looks bad, God's in charge still. He's still working out a plan. And we don't even know to what degree we are part of that plan in a dynamic way. Sometimes people who thought I have nothing to contribute so much. Because God's in charge, not us. Notice, in the days that the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. Now, remember when God brought Israel to the land, he promised them a land of milk and honey, a plenteous land, wonderful crops, right? Lots of cattle, a place to sort of have a steak, build your location. It looked like a good deal before they came across. And it would have been a good deal except for one thing. Their unfaithfulness. Not an unfaithfulness that invalidated God's plans and covenant, but an unfaithfulness that hurt them in their life and for God and with others. It's something that invalidated their own activities. It didn't change God's plan. So when the judges judged, man, it would have been a terrible time to live, but it's because of their unfaithfulness. Now, notice in Deuteronomy when it talks about, if you do what I say to do, you honor me, you worship me, and all of these things you do, you'll be blessed. On the other hand, if you choose to go the other way, find your own way, do it your own way, and follow after other things besides what I've commanded, you'll be cursed. And then he explains to them, let me explain what I mean by cursed. He says, you're going to have famines. You're going to have difficulties. You're going to be invaded by armies. When you get on the naughty list with God, he has a way to bring you back. And sometimes it's painful. But eventually he brings you back. Why? Because you're not saved by your works. You're saved by his grace. But that does not mean he hasn't got ways to make you act better. And so the fact is, at this time of they should have been living in plenty, they had a famine. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. That's an amazing statement. The fact there, here he is in the land of promise, the land that is the land of Israel, the land that he's supposed to work in and be part of, and a famine hits it, and he hightails it to across the Salt Sea, or they used to call it Salt Sea. We call it the Dead Sea. But the point is they have to go on the other side of that, and they begin to live in a land supposedly which has more for them. Can you imagine Christians acting this way, that things begin to be problematic, and they thought, let me see, where can I find something better? I know what, I'll go be where the pagans are. That's essentially what they did. They were saying they're moving away. Now, I'm not suggesting this happened with COVID, because a lot of people from blue states, including me, moved to the land of promise. But nonetheless, what if you had lived in the land of promise and moved to a blue state? Now, that would be a tragedy, right? By the way, I want to mention something to you. I have a book up here. This is a brand new published book. It's not mine. It's a friend of mine that you may want to look at on Amazon. It's called The Old Testament Really Matters, A Call for Believers to Read the Bible of Jesus and the Early Church. And Dr. Kaiser, he said, I wanted to write this for 50 years, one of the most preeminent scholars in the world. And he said, I wanted to get this book done on why the Old Testament matters. Let me tell you something. The Old Testament really matters because it's the Bible of Jesus and the early church, but it's also inspired of God, and the things that it talks about are still being fulfilled. And so the book of Ruth is just one of the many books that have so much meat in them if we'll take time to read them and think about them and grow from them. I hope that will happen to you today, because what you find is that in the midst of a lot of coal, there was a beautiful diamond. When you're looking around and you're seeing the days of the judges judge, you say, wow, what a terrible time. And there you have a beautiful story of God's work, the hidden God who's in control. See, God is hidden to us pretty well. Unless you perform miracles today like some do, God really, by and large, is not doing the spectacular things you wish he would. God, just show yourself to be true by doing this. Be a Gideon. That's what he did. He had a command to do something, and he says, you know, if I could only have some really good proof. And then he got it, and he said, well, let's try it another way. Because he's always, I'm not sure if I want to do that, so I really want double evidence. See? I love that passage out of Peter when he talks to the people that he wrote to in northwestern Turkey, Asia Minor of the days. And he talks about he was with the other apostles on the Mount of Transfiguration. He saw the glory of God. He heard the words of God. He had all this evidence that all of us want. God, show yourself. And he says to these people, you have not seen or heard him, and yet you love him. I would suspect, unless we have a supernatural person here, I would suspect that that's our entire experience. Each of us, we've not had the experience that Peter did as an eyewitness, and yet we love him. We believe the truth that has been spoken from the Word. We don't have all that many would want to have, but we have the adequate amount to love him. And we have the adequate amount to live for him and follow him. Because God, by and large, is hidden. Did you notice that? Unless you guys are having theophanies up here sometime when I'm not around, God is hidden. Some people say, I've got to have a miracle like a Gideon. And yet God is hidden. The hidden God, however, is behind the scenes putting it all together. And here in the midst of a land of famine comes a story of beauty. So we have the best of times and the worst of times, but what we do is have the same consistent God who's in control. So what happens is that when these judges ruled, they went to Moab. Now, Moab is just right across the way. You know, you can see here Bethlehem just a little bit south of Jerusalem. You go right around the tip of, this is the river Jordan. Here's the Dead Sea, or the Salt Sea, as it's called in the Old Testament. And right down into Moab. You got the Ammonites, you got the Moabites. Down here you have the Edomites. All the Ites are there except the Israelites, except all of a sudden Elimelech and his family, Israelites, come in. They brought some more Ites in. So what you have, though, is a move there that lasted for 10 years. Because there seemed to be better conditions in reference to food and other provisions, but the conditions are off because they're in the midst of pagans and rather than being in the land of Israel that had been given to them, which I think is sort of an irony in the thing, that they go to the pagans when they have the land of promise. These are just some pictures across the way. If you were actually Ruth, not Ruth, but if you were Elimelech and others, this is sort of what the land of plenty looks like, the Moabites. Now, the man's name was Elimelech. El is the word for God, and E is my God, Eli. If your name is Eli, or Eli, it's my God. Melech is the word for king. So Elimelech means my God is king. And yet the one who was named my God is king apparently didn't think he was king enough. So he moves across the Jordan River down by the Dead Sea down to Moab to be. And, of course, what we find takes place, he takes his wife Naomi, which means pleasant. We'll find that's important later. Because when she's going across the land, she's pleasant. After a while, she's not as pleasant. But she has two sons, Machon and Cleon. And these people, their names are very fascinating because they basically mean weak and sickly. So she has two sons named weak and sickly. And so they go across to the land of Moab. And while there among the Moabites, they get married, which happens sometimes when people that are believers find themselves in the midst of pagans. It's not uncommon that you'll have some believers who will marry pagans. And that's what happened to the land of Moab. These are the people that they associated with all the time. And so I'm showing you the picture. This is a true-to-life picture. This really is how they looked. Going across the land down into Moab. They seem excited at the point that they go. They're not as excited later. They took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah. By the way, I, on the birth certificate, Orpah got changed to Oprah for somebody. But actually, they mixed the letters up there. It must probably be a birth certificate problem. And the name of the other is Ruth. And Ruth means friendly, someone who's a good companion. And so these individuals married Orpah and Ruth, the sons Machon and Chilion, and the sons died while they were down in Moab, apparently toward the end of the time of the 10 years. So they got ready to go back to the land of Canaan, the land of Israel. They heard that Yahweh had visited his people by giving them bread. Now, probably Yahweh, the God of Israel, decided to visit his people because people had been praying. Because the whole issue of the blessing and cursing relates to I bring cursing for the purpose of getting you in shape to appreciate some blessing. In other words, as long as everything looks great, you never learn a lot. Usually it's a time of difficulty and you say, you know, I'm going to turn back to God. And at that point, God brings blessing. And so I suspect there's something going on here. But what happens that Ruth and Naomi and a person, this Orpah, are going back to the land. Now, I can't go through all this in detail because I'm going somewhere with all of this. But notice, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go return each to her mother's house. In other words, don't go with me back to Israel, but go home to the Moabite family that you came from. And, of course, we know in this story that the woman by the name of Orpah, which we don't know anything more about, she didn't stay in the story, Orpah, she went back home. But Ruth, this one who was pleasant, she hung to Naomi and says, no, I want to go with you. Now, why would that be? We don't have any background on why that's so. Was Ruth's husband, did he somehow convince her of the importance of being in Israel? You know, what was it that caused her to go? But it demonstrates at least this much, that she is holding on to her mother-in-law. They had a great bond that formed. And so she says, you know, no, I want to go with you. And of course, we have this long story that we're not going to go into. And Naomi says, I can't do any good for you. I can't get pregnant again. I can't have my husband, my children to grow until the time that they can marry you, and on and on. That's all interesting, but we'll not cover that. But the point of it is, Naomi tries to dissuade Ruth from going. But Ruth says, you know, I'm going to go with you. And he says, my people, or your people, will be my people. And here's the key, your God will be my God. Now, her god at this point had been Chemosh, and now she's moving to a god called Yahweh, and that's very important. Ruth clung to her, but not just to her. Ruth began to cling to the God of Israel, which means it's possible for a pagan to convert. We find that an example with one called in the Bible, a woman called Tamar, who for whatever reason helped the Israelites. And we find this example with Ruth. Occasionally you find these situations, and what happens is that they come across the land. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die. Yahweh, do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. This is someone you want for a daughter-in-law, someone who really stays with you. And so, but notice how Naomi responds in verse 20. She says, you know, I'm so disappointed in all of this. Now, she's just got through having a daughter-in-law who's willing to give everything to be with her, to take care of her, to cling to her, to be faithful to her. And the next response of Naomi, the one's name which means someone who is pleasant, she says, don't call me Naomi anymore, call me Mara. Now that sounds, you hear that word, Mara. It sounds sort of negative anyway, doesn't it? Well, it ought to be because it means bitter. She says, don't call me pleasant, call me a bitter woman. Now she's got this really wonderful person going back to the land of Israel with her, but she can't see the goods of it. She can only see the bad. She's lost her husband, two children. We understand that. But now she's going back to the land of promise, and she has a daughter-in-law who wants to stick with her. And she says, I'm just bitter because the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. Now, I know none of us are this way, but sometimes we can't see the good for all the bad. And I think about this COVID situation. What is the good? One is I live in Texas, not the land of I told people, I said, I'm leaving the left coast to come to the land of freedom. And, of course, I grew up here. I was born here. I have a right to be here and reared here and went through most of my schooling here. But, you know, the fact is we have to count those things that are good, not just those things that are bad. It's so easy to get focused on the bad and not the good. And Naomi needed to turn around. You know what, though? By the end of the story, she gets her act together. And we see why. Because the hidden God, who's in control, he begins to pull it together for her. And that's how God does things sometimes. We just have to do what they call wait on the Lord. You ever done that? Times seem a certain way. You just keep praying and waiting on the Lord. He puts it together because he's in control. What God does, though, in working in the world, in each of our lives, and sometimes periods of time which are not just extravagant, or not everything is just rosy and wonderful. God is still there, and he's bringing about things that we have to wait for, and that's what we're going to learn in this story. Well, they get there, and she's saying, I'm just so bitter, I hate everything, and, God has afflicted me. And they get there a certain time of the year, the year of the time of barley harvest. In case you don't know what barley is, there it is, barley harvest. And this becomes central to the story because you have a man who owns the field, and we know his name. His name is Boaz. And so Naomi says, listen, we have someone who has a nice field to go to, who's of the family of Elimelech. His name is Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said, let me go to the field and glean heads of grain. Now, by the way, they had a policy in Israel in those days. This might be a good one to think about. They had a policy in Israel that if you were poor, you were not left destitute. So what would happen is that leaders of the country would go out when they had opportunity and glean the fields for you and bring it to your homes. I think I got that mixed up. What happened is that they provided a certain portion of the field that you, if you go out and work and gather it, you can take it home. I think that's a real good policy on people because they maintain dignity in the midst of difficulty. You understand what I'm saying? I was being facetious on the other in case you took me wrong. Because what happens is that a better policy is always to take care of people in need, but let them maintain their dignity in the process rather than just give it out. You understand me? I think there's something to think about there because you need to help people, but people also need to maintain their dignity of gaining from what they work with. You understand what I'm saying? But that's what Israel did as their policy. And so Ruth, this young woman, she goes out into the field to not get a handout, but to be involved in the work of bringing in the food. And so that's what she does. And when she does that, she comes. There's Ruth, in case you haven't ever seen her. Ruth, she's out there in the field, and she doesn't know much about this man called Boaz, but he owns the field because Naomi has told her that. And so let me go to the field and glean heads of grain. And so she's out there getting these pieces of grain on the corners of the field. And what happens is that you have a guy by the name of Boaz who comes to the place. Now, I'm sure it's purely by accident that he happens to show up. But we do know that he comes out. It just so happened. I think that's what it says. It just so happened that he came out there and he says, who is this new person in the field? Now, have you ever noticed God is a God who puts things together in the right way? I've had people say, man, that car almost hit me. Thank the Lord. Well, why did it almost hit you? Why didn't it hit you? Sometimes when we give thanks, we need to recognize that God is in charge. He's behind the scenes. Sometimes I have been in situations where I've barely been almost hit in an accident, and I'm thinking if I had been 1 second difference or 2 seconds difference or, you know, a yard closer or whatever it may be, that something could have happened, and I'm thinking, but why am I 1 second late or 1 second early? God's in charge to the molecules, to the itty-bitty points of seconds. God is in charge. Now, again, it may be that I stopped and said, you know, I think I'm going to change my tie. And that gives me just enough time to be not in the wreck. You understand? I was watching anybody ever watch the movie called Highway to Heaven? Just like Touched by an Angel, it's off theologically, but it's interesting to watch. And I like Michael Landon from the old days of the, what was it called? No, well, that's Highway to Heaven, Little House on the Prairie, and then you had the Bonanza. I was trying to think. On the Ponderosa, Bonanza. And so I like that. And, of course, I watch Little Joe. He keeps going on the movies. And so he has this guy with him, and the guy was upset about something that happened on the road and so forth. And he says, well, I tell you what, God's going to let you have your wishes. And so he does, and by the time he finishes doing God's job for him, everything had really screwed up. See, we think we can do something when we just need to rely upon God in the background. I think that's why we wait on the Lord. Sometimes we pray. We recognize that God is in charge of situations. And I'm not saying we never act, but I just think we can't be presumptuous to think, if I were God, it would be this way. If I were God, you know, if you were God, you'd do exactly what God does. But you can't be God. But if you were, if you want to do a hypothetical like that, you'd be doing it the right way, not the way you're going to do it, as not God. And so you have Boaz come to the field, and he sees this young woman, and he's intrigued by her and finds out about her. And he says, do not go to glean in any other field. You know, stay here and let my men help you out here. And he sort of helps her and helps Naomi out. She bowed down before him, and we know that we have this story then begins, a romance begins. Now, there's something that we need to understand. We don't have it in our society today. It was called a near kinsman, sometimes called a kinsman redeemer in the text. And the way it worked is that if, in fact, an individual, a relative, usually oftentimes a brother, and this happens with Judah and a woman in Genesis 37 or wherever it is, where you have a marriage to the next son. The reason why is to maintain the posterity of the family and not just go somewhere else. You maintain the posterity from your brother. And this is not something we practice, and I know some of you may have some real difficulty with this view, but the point of it is that's the way they did it in Israel, and God set it up so you can talk to him about it. But the fact is, a kinsman redeemer is someone who is a near kinsman. If, in fact, someone died in the family, you have a duty to take the wife to bear children unto the son or the whatever that was lost. And that's what Boaz is to Ruth. Come to find out, this Moabitess was married, and we don't know whether it's McClone or Caerleon, either one, they were a bad choice. But the one, whichever one that was her husband, she then is someone who is to marry a kinsman redeemer. And it just so happened that Boaz came to the field and met Ruth that day and found this information out. And the story continues on some wonderful things that occur and some that are very difficult for us to know what to deal with. But you find that Boaz takes a special liking to Ruth. So unbeknownst to her, he makes sure that his guys take care of her. And so she has plenty to deal with, and Naomi can be fed and Ruth can be fed. And so what happens as we move on through here, several times in the text, we're going to find that even though you don't see any divine works of God occurring and miraculous events and spectacular kinds of things, it's very subtle. God doesn't always work in big splashes. Sometimes it's very subtle. And that's what's happening here. Behind the scenes, people living their daily lives, and I teach this for this reason, because most of us do not have spectacular existence. You know, working through life, and every day it's a new adventure, and, you know, something splashing on the screen. That's not how God works. And I know some people, you know, expect a miracle every day. And all we used to say is about Oral Roberts. Expect a miracle every day. Expect a miracle in every way. You know, expect life to be just miraculous, constantly happening. I don't know of many people who live lives that way. Do you? Life is sort of, it goes on, you know. Sometimes a little humdrum, this and that. You're just making your living. You're doing the things you need to do. You're rearing your children. You're visiting people. You have relationships. It's not spectacular. It's sort of normal. And that's what we're having here, because God, behind the scenes in our normality, is working out his plan. And we don't even know what it is. Matter of fact, we're going to be surprised, I think, when we go to be with the Lord, and for some of us, it's closer than others. I'm trying my best to start going backwards, but it just won't work. The point of it is we're all moving somewhere, right? And we're going to be surprised, I think, when we get to be with the Lord and see what has occurred in the background that we didn't know. I do. And I think this story tells us that. Because, you know, they say to you, you know, bless Yahweh, the God of Israel, you know. Blessed be Yahweh who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead. That's what Naomi says. This woman's been walking around like them, you know, like that. Bitter woman. All of a sudden she gets a spark. And then she says, oh, something really cool has happened. Naomi's met Boaz, and God has remembered us after all. Well, she could have been more happy and experienced it the same way, I suspect. So anyway, you stay close by him because he's your kinsman redeemer. So, moving on. Now, something special happens here, because Naomi, after she gets an understanding that Ruth, it's a love story, that Ruth and Boaz have sort of gotten together a little bit, Naomi is behind the scenes making plans. And so she maneuvers things. She said, listen, they're going to have this big thing going on, and what I want you to do is go there, be sure and be there at night, and when Boaz lies down, now I'm sorry to tell you this, when Boaz lies down and goes to sleep, she has Ruth to go there in the middle of the night, which most of us would not consider to be appropriate. You wouldn't let your daughter do this. Ruth is saying, Naomi's saying, now Ruth, here's what you do. Go down there and you uncover his feet. Now, what you have going on in this passage is something in which Ruth is telling Boaz, Boaz, you are my near kinsman. You're my kinsman redeemer. You have a duty under Israelite law to marry and bear children to my former husband, at least two children. You have that duty. And so Boaz becomes aware of it, and I'll let you read there's a great book on commentary on Ruth where the guy explains all of this, but I'm not going to explain it in church. But anyway, the point of it is, what's going on here is that she's telling him very plainly, you have a duty to me under the law. So you may like me, and we're sort of hanging out together and all that, and that's all really great and good, but we need to get more serious about this. And so that's what she does with Boaz, and he gets the word. He understands, uh-oh, I have a duty. But he's seen Ruth. He's been around her. He likes her. He thinks that's not such a bad deal because he likes her anyway. It's obvious from reading. And so what you find is that Ruth then lies at his feet and uncovers his feet. And I'll say all that about that. And here are the pictures, and we'll go on. Now, what it says, stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that he will perform the duty of a close relative for you. Let him do it. But if he does not want to perform the duty for you, then I will perform the duty for you as Yahweh lives. He says, listen, I understand my responsibilities. I'm going to follow through with following the law. And matter of fact, this is one of the better days that following the law is a good idea. And I know Boaz is thinking that. Just read the text. He's thinking, you know, sometimes I just really love following the law. And so he says, I'll do it. But he says, there may be another guy in the way. I might be number two as a kinsman redeemer, not number one. And so you move through here for that, and you find out that he actually has a little thing in which he's fairly smooth, because he comes to this other alternative of the kinsman redeemer. And he says, you're actually before me in line. And the guy says, okay, well, then great. I'll be glad to marry her. He says, oh, by the way, if you marry her, you have to purchase all the land of Elimelech. The guy said, I don't want to purchase all the land of Elimelech. He said, that's the deal. That's the way it works. And he says, okay, I'll tell you what. You can marry her. And then they had a way in which they signified that I will not follow the covenant on this, because I'm going to let it skip me and go to you. And he took off his shoe and gave it to the other person. Now you say, why would you do that? Hey, we have a lot of weird customs too. So however it happens, this is a way publicly in front of other people at the gate of the city. By the way, every time you see the gate of the city in the Bible when you have people gathered, you need to understand, in the ancient world, this is true at Lot sitting at the gate of the city in Sodom, here in Bethlehem. When the men sat around the gate of the city and talked, that was the courthouse for people. That's where they dealt with business. So the gate of the city was important. That was the courthouse in the ancient world. And so they're there, and here all the city fathers are there. And here you take this man who hands the shoe to Boaz and says, you take her. And then he says, great, I'll take her and I'll purchase the land of Elimelech, which is what occurred. Now, what I want to do now from this is, notice, Ruth of Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon. Oh, there it says, Mahlon. I have acquired as my wife to perpetrate the name of the dead through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from his position at the gate. See, so that's what it was all about, is to take on that statement. Now, Yahweh gave her conception, because now he's doing his duty, and she bore a son called Obed. Then the woman said to Naomi, blessed be Yahweh who has not left you this day without a close relative. May his name be famous in Israel. Now, we're going to move from that to something important, because we see that from Obed came a man called Jesse, and from Jesse came a man called David the king. Now, who would have thought that from a Moabitess and Boaz, an older man, who would bear a child from Machlon, the son, would come Obed with Jesse and finally David the king? They couldn't plan that. God had planned it. But see, the significance of this story is the fact that this particular book of Ruth is written probably in the time of David, looking back two centuries earlier about the things going on in Israel. And all the time God had been putting it together. Now, the reason why it's important to have David the king as part of this story, if you go to Matthew, you'll see that Ruth and Boaz are in the genealogies because they gave rise to the son of to David, because eventually comes from David, the son of David, who is Jesus the Messiah. But nobody would have anticipated this. See, when things are going around, we don't know what God is planning. That's why I call this story the hidden God who's in control. Because behind the scenes, God is working out his will. So let's look at just a few theological things that we learn from this. First of all, we find that Yahweh is found 17 times in the book. Now, I know that people see the word L-O-R-D in caps, and I won't go into the whole story on that, but that's not the name of God. Lord is not the name of God. The name of God is Yahweh. And it's clear in the Old Testament from Exodus chapter 3, Yahweh says to Moses, he said, go tell them Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He said, this is my name to be remembered by for all generations. And, of course, people forget it. So the point of it is that is, in fact, the name of God. It means he who is. So God says, I am that I am, you know, which is the word Ehyeh, Esher Ehyeh. I am that I am, say Yahweh, which is the third person singular of that. And it says, yes, he is. He is what he says. And that's something you need about God, because God, by his name, says, you know, when he speaks of himself, he says, I am the existent one. I'm the one in charge. I'm everything. I'm eternity. I am what I am. And we say, yes, he is. Yes, he is. We don't contradict him. We say, yes, he is. And that's what I'm saying to you today in this book. The fact is, God is who he claims to be. God is involved. God is in charge. He's behind the scenes working out things to bring himself glory. Now, you may get benefit in all of this, but don't think it's for your glory. God is working out things for his own glory. And for that, we should be thankful. He has a right to. Matter of fact, he deserves it. And what I get by grace, not by my works. See, I don't have something because I'm a better person than someone else. I have something because God is gracious to me. And that's what he is to you. And so the fact God's name is found a number of times in the book. We find a lot of praying in this book. And you'll find all sorts of statements that go prayers for the family's prosperity, benedictions. On and on you find references to prayer and God throughout the book, even though we don't find God himself doing that much visibly, in a way in which people noticed it. It just kept happening behind the scenes. All the plans begin to fit. Years ago, I had many of you are familiar with Corrie ten Boom. I had the privilege of being with her many years ago, and a time to talk to her and be with her and introduce her and stuff. And she had a great story in which she had this little tapestry. And behind the scenes were all these little beautiful colors and strands and so forth. And it looked like a mishmash of, what is this? It's a bunch of nonsense. It's pretty colors. But then she turned it around, and it was a tapestry of beautiful artwork. Behind the scenes, from our perspective, it looked like, I don't know why it's happening as it is. I mean, what's going on here? Why is Elimelech going to Moab? You know, why is Ruth coming back? Why are all these things happening? Those are those strands at the other side. When you turn it around from God's perspective, he sees all the things fitting. Everything makes perfectly good sense. And that's what we have here. God is sometimes hidden in our life. Difficulty, sickness, persecution, God seems absent. The book of Ruth displays forcefully the truth that God is acting to fulfill his promises and care for his people. He answers prayers and he acts upon his promises. And so I can assure you today from this little book that I didn't have time to hardly get into it, but the big portions of the story are this. I'm not looking for spectacular. If God brings it, so be it. What I'm needing to be in prayer and asking God to work, knowing that he will, in fact, work out his will in our lives and make things as he wants them to be. Not necessarily how we want them to be, but how he wants them to be for his glory and for our benefit. And that's a lot more than this spectacular things that people on TV sometimes do. Let me pray. Lord, we just give you thanks because you have revealed yourself so many places in your word. And you revealed yourselves in our lives, sometimes ways in which we had not anticipated, certainly ways that sometimes are not what people want, but in ways that fulfill your purposes. Lord, help us to be prayerful. Help us to be waitful on you. Lord, help us to glorify you in all that we do because we know you, in fact, are in charge. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.